session number 14788, reel 4.
Reel 4. Now, do you remember anything about the journey to Mercer Matruh?
Exactly. Oh, you mean from Palestine to Mercer Matruh? I remember crossing the Suez. I thought, which way are we going? Kantara, is it? Kantara East and Kantara West, yeah. And we crossed there and got the old train, and it was a long, long sort of way. I mean, we seemed to be going to nowhere because we didn't know where we were going. And all we could see out of the window was just sort of sand and one or two donkeys and things like that. And none of the people with us had been in that sort of area before. So, I mean, they couldn't say, well, that's so-and-so or that's so-and-so, because they were strangers like we were. So we just had to wait until we finally arrived at Mercer Matruh.
Now, what was happening when you got there? There was a bit of a rare raid and things going on, but I think it had finished before you got there. What was the first thing you remember doing at Mercer?
Well, trying to dig a slit trench. And it was very, very hard. I mean, it was like concrete. You could get down sort of so far, I mean, probably that way, and you could lie a long ways, not sort of down, because your head was sticking out of the ground. So basically, I mean, you made as much as you could of the, it wasn't like a sand pit, I mean, like seaside. It was really hard rock. So my sort of billet was on the seafront. I always remember I used to have a swim first thing in the morning, straight out of my little bivvy and in the nude and straight in the sea. That was right on the seafront.
What was your bivvy like? Can you describe it?
Well, it was like a one-man bivvy, sort of tent, and that was it. I mean, you probably sort of made your own. You didn't want blankets and things like that because it was too hot. But I mean, you got down, and people were all over the place. There was nothing sort of concrete. I never had a hut to go into. I mean, I was always on there.
And so 425 battery, your signallers were back towards the beach, were they?
Well, you could. I wouldn't say back towards the beach, but we were sort of a combined unit. I mean, we were sort of, well, in our own rights, we were sort of the kingpins. If you're a flagger, you're sort of a bit above everyone else. I mean, you never mix with the gunners, so you're sort of on your own kind of thing. I mean,
so you were away from the main body.
Yeah, if the guns were having gun practice, I mean, that had nothing to do with us. I mean, we'd probably be doing signaling and things like that.
Now, what about the high-level Italian bombing while you were there? What was that like?
Well, it's frightening, for a start. But the Savoia bombers used to come in from Italy, and apparently they were about 270 miles an hour, fully loaded. And our air support then was Gloucester Glads. I mean, we had about, I think, 9 Gloucester Gladiators. Their top speed was about 180 miles an hour. So imagine how we felt. They were sort of protecting us, and the bombers could go faster than they could load it. And when they dropped the first lot of bombs, I mean, I was terrified. I mean, I was, what, 22, 23. But there's some people that had gone into the ETA probably 17, 18. I think Frank Knowles, he was 3 years younger than me or 4 years younger than me, and he was in before I was. So in actual fact, I mean, they'd been in the 18s, 17s. Imagine a bomb coming down. It's frightening. And I was, say, 22. But when the first came down, you could actually hear them and thought, well, this is it. And when they landed, I mean, there's people running about, been hit and were screaming and, you know, one or two real bad casualties. But I don't know if I kind of looked quite out the back of my mind because it was too frightening to you know, imagine it. Too frightening.
Did you ever get used to it, the high level risk?
No, never. No.
Now, sometimes they wouldn't let you run to slit trenches. I mean, they issued orders. I mean, did that ever have any effect on you, or would you always?
Well, no. I mean, it's like salvation. I mean, you sort of dive where you want. I mean, if you was going running along and you heard everyone screaming, you'd sort of dive anywhere, just to sort of... I picked up a boulder once thinking it would protect me. It was stupid, you know. But that's in the heat of the moment.
Did you have any close escapes from at Mercer as opposed to Tobruk?
Not myself personally, no.
And what was your sort of daily routine like then as a signaller? What time would your day start?
Well, some say you'd probably go to the valley or say 6 o'clock or 6:30. Then you get one or two NCOs running around, say shouting orders and saying do this and do that. And but some say signallers basically, I mean, that they've got their own sort of work to do. I mean, they've got to maintain the wire, and that was the biggest job, maintaining the wire. You got your batteries to fill and check it. So basically they say, we'll leave you to it. Oh, okay. That was it, away. You'd probably have a bomber day come round and try to be, you know, sort of, what are you doing? Oh, they've got this wire to do, see? So you could arrange your own job to suit yourself.
What's a bomber day? A sergeant or...?
Bomber day, two tape. Yeah.
And what was your food like?
Well, I can't remember much about it really, but I don't think it was very clever because army rations, I mean, unless it's looked after properly, I mean, I think the big thing was in the army that you hadn't got the proper people in the proper jobs.
In what way?
Well, I mean, a bloke in Civil Street might be a cook and a really good lad, but they wouldn't have let him be a cook in the army. He'd probably be a sergeant on the guns or sergeant. So it wasn't. It's like in Civil Street. I mean, I know councillors, and they're councillors, and in their own job, they're like in charge. They've got probably 30 wagons, but they wouldn't put them on the transport in the council because they might fiddle. So they all swap jobs. The bloke goes to the accountant, he can't go to the treasury office because he'd be fiddling. So they put him on sweeping the charge of the sort of, well, cleansing department. And that's how they did in the army, a lot of people. They just put square pegs in round holes. Well, you can tell that with officers, can't you?
In what way?
Well, some were really good blokes, and they were good to you, and you could look up to him. I mean, like Peter Birkin, I mean, he had a few things said about him, but as a soldier, he was A1. I mean, when we got into the book, I mean, I followed him everywhere. If he said do this, I'd do that. If he said, well, no, do that, I would do it.
What inspired you about him, then?
Well, he was sort of... he looked a soldier, you know, when he was tucked up in his uniform and his manner and his attitude, and he wouldn't ask you to do a job unless he could do it himself.
Did your mum, you know, he was a homosexual?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Did you know about that at the time?
Oh, yeah, everybody did. I mean, it used to be a sort of... this is no respect to Peter, because, I mean, everybody knew that, but there used to be a story going on that you say to, I'll say a lance bomber, there, one strike. Say, I think we'll go up to point so-and-so today on the map. He said, oh, by the way, I said, I've just dropped my maps down there. Would you pick them up for me, bomber, dear? You know, and straight away he's got two days instead of one. And people said, he's another one of the Birkin. And that was a story that went round. So if a man went up as a lance bomber day and came back a bomber day, he'd been playing happy families, you see.
Did you believe all that, though?
Well, it was that sort of thing that bandied about all the time, that you sort of half didn't want to believe it and half believe it. I mean, the story we went, there was some bloke came to stay with him for a couple of days, someone in the RAF, and this RAF bloke went back and accused Peter of, you know, sort of messing about him. And they took the case out of Nottingham down to Oxford. And they even took the bathroom door with the handle and everything off its sort of hinges, to the court to prove that he couldn't have done this and that, sort of the handle going this way or that way. Because, but so describe the bathroom like. Say he'd been in the same bathroom as Peter, and they argued the system of, did that go that way or did that go that way?
Was that post-war?
Yeah.
Who else would did you really reckon as an officer?
Well, there's Slim. He got killed, of course. He was a good chap, and.
And who didn't you like?
Well, I didn't used to like Willie for a matter of. I didn't know much about him, but Willie, I didn't go much on Willie Pingle. He seemed to be a bit sort of. Well, because. I didn't like him because he put me on the guns for a start. And
when did that happen?
Interval.
Right, we'll come on to that then. Now, what would you do for recreations in Mercer? Do you remember anything?
Oh, very little. Probably kick a buff football round or, you know, play rounders and cricket. I was playing rugby with Slint because he was quite a good rugby man. And I was on about 9 stone then. I mean, playing rugby with a bloke about 6'4", I mean. Yeah. Or play cards, I mean.
Did you gamble? I mean, would you bet?
A lot of card shops. Oh, aye.
Did you win?
Oh, no.
What games would they play?
What, solo? Well, I learned to play bridge at one camp. The one bloke used to get his pay in his hand like that, and you sit under a tree waiting for the boys to come and bring the money to him, pay cars. And that was it. Oh, Sam Long then. Yeah. Everybody knew where Sam was when you find a tree with a bit of shade, and that was it. And all the lads would collect round. I've seen him draw his pay and biscuit the same night.
He'd lose then?
Then all the lads would. Well, he'd win and he'd lose, but I mean, if he was skint the same night, the lads would chip in a couple of piastres or whatever. Then you go down to the pub and have a couple of pints and be quite happy.
Not in Mercer, wouldn't it?
But oh,
yeah,
no,
but
no,
yeah.
No.
Anything else you remember about your time in Mercer?
I remember the first Christmas in Mercer.
Yes. So you didn't, just to make it clear, you didn't go off on this Wavell offensive business in December?
Oh, no,
You didn't go with Hingston or.
No, I stayed in
Birkin.
There was quite a lot of people went up there. I mean, my pal, he was a signaller, and he went up there, but I didn't. I stayed in Interbrook all the Mesmature all the time.
So what about the Christmas then? What do you remember of it?
Well, we had one of the best Christmases out, because I mean, the first Christmas abroad, and we thought, well, here we are, Mesmature, and nice weather, the old sea there, and running about half naked, and I was quite happy. And I thought, well, Christmas is coming, what shall we do? Shall we get anything? Or? And in Egypt, the chickens, they're about a bit bigger than a big pigeon, really. And they got baths full of these. And of course, the lads were jugging up as well and getting ready. And I always remember them wandering around saying, do you want a chicken, kid? Do you want a chicken? And they got baths full of chickens. You could help yourself to a chicken. Well, it was only a mouthful, really. But there was bathfuls, really chock-a-block. Really enjoyed myself there, maybe true. And of course, we made a choir and we used to have singing lessons and we used to have the old rounders. You remember the rounders? London's burning, London's burning, you London. All that kind of thing. That's to get down to a sandstorm and things like that when you couldn't do much. The old sandstorms used to blow you to pieces.
What, at Mercer? Yeah. What were they like? What was it like being in a proper sandstorm then?
Ooh, terrible. They have a Khamseen as well, which Khamseen wind, which comes from the desert. And it's like opening an oven door all the time. And you can't breathe. Terrible. And I had a quotation of that in a book at home, and I've lost it. And I sent it to my pal in Australia. And he thought I'd written it, but I hadn't. It was in this book, Camp Scene. And in the bottom, it says what it was, Arabic for West. I think it's in France. They've got a mistral.
Yeah.
It's something like that. See, but in Arabic, it says this is a Camp Scene. And I always remember when it came in, you couldn't breathe. You know. It was hot on your face. It's like opening the door all the time. It was terrible.
Did you have any problem with desert sores while you were at Mercer? Things like that?
I had blood poisoning.
How did that happen?
Well, I got a sore on my finger there. And I looked at my arm one day and I was hallucinating. I thought there was something wrong with me somewhere. I could imagine things and see things. And I even picked up a rifle and started aiming at people. And they snatched it up and said, hey, Parker's gone mad. Yeah. He said, better go and see it. Go and see the crack. That was old Finnegan. And went down and he said, well, we should get you down to the base. And I went down to the base and that they filled me with M&Bs and all kind of things. And by then he'd gone right up my arm and it was like a red streak light right up my arm, underneath my arm. And that was all from blood poisoning, yeah.
And when you say back to base, back to Cairo?
Yeah.
And
I said down there, well, you better stop down here because you're not very well and we'll look after you. I said, well, I want to go back to Vienna. And eventually they said, well, you know, if you want to go back, we'll let you go back. They went back.
You were keen to get back to the...
Yeah. Well, you got all your mates. I mean, you get down the base and they sent you to any old, you know, you didn't know where you were going to go land up. I mean, it's like you sort of having 20 mates and you know them. You know how they live and how they breathe and what they do and how they sort of play. I mean, it's they're almost like a big family. I mean, you are a happy family or you're not a happy family. And I always look. See, I was single at the time. I might have married now, but I was single at the time. I got no ties. My mother died. My dad was. I got a brother at home, and my dad was with him. So I thought, well, while I'm here, I might as well make the best of it. And everything that happened while I was over there, or even back to prisoner war days, I didn't worry. I just carried on. I mean, I was single, and that's what's the big thing. I mean, there's no worries at home.
So, yeah, after Christmas, anything else about Mercer? Because they then went up the canal, Suez Canal, on mine watching.
Went on the canal, that's right.
Is there no more you remember about Mercer then?
No, except that Christmas time with the old bath full of chickens.
Now, what do you remember about... You went down to the canal and they were spread along in posts, I think. What do you remember of that?
Well, it was a real... I mean, for a terrier unit to be on the canal, it didn't seem to sort of make sense to us. And what we had to do, there were nets over the canal, like a tennis net. And the idea was that when Jerry was coming over, he was dropping these magnetic mines. And our job was to pinpoint them, take a bearing on them, where you thought they'd come from, and then put a trace on the floor in the direction it was, and then ring the HQ. I don't know where they were ringing, sort of people further up the canal, and tell them what had happened. And there's so many.
A tracer, what do you mean? A stick or.
Stick, yeah. It's like being in the Boy Scouts, you know, sort of pointing a stick. Because you see the old watch tapes coming down, and one there, and you take a bearing on it, say 240, 256, 27, then put a stick on the floor, and then so it came in that direction, you see. Then they collate all these things opposite together, and say, well, he saw one there, and he saw one there. And the idea was that Jay was dropping these things in to obviously, you know, to bug the canal up. And eventually they did do it. They kept saying, oh, it was fed up with your blacks, you know, army blacks, you keep ringing through, so and so and so and so. I said, we're certain there's nothing wrong at all. I says, give it a couple of days, and you just have a thing like that going up the canal.
Thing like what, sorry?
A boat, whatever it was, a frigate or something. And you just have a big cable at the back of it. And that was electric charged. And the idea was that the charger went through the water and agitated the water and needs to fire on the front of the boat into the water. So by the time they'd passed over, they were clear for if a mine went up. And they kept saying, well, there's nothing in there. And eventually a mine did go up. And it caught a boat and they managed to sort of bring it into the side. Because in the canal itself, you could walk out, say, from here to there, and you'd be about that.
A yard or two.
And all of a sudden, if you took another step, you'd go you'd go down, which happened to a lot of the boats, you know. They say, well, nothing to it, you know. They'd paddle out, and all of a sudden, it'd disappear. And this boat was beached, and the lads used to run up and down. We were dug into a slip trench on the side of the canal, and that was a bit rough because you nothing to do, you know, no sort of community. Well, I think it was four in our little hut.
Would you all be signallers?
We would be, yeah. We didn't know what happened down the canal because they go down to the Bitter Lakes and there was spread all right down the side.
Did you get into any of the local towns for a drink or recreation?
No, no. Once went into a brothel.
What do you remember of that?
I just remember going in and she said, you know, how much, Johnny? I said, oh, what do you want to bargain, you know? But you've got to be very, very careful because outside you could have the old man, chop you down. If you went outside, you've got to be careful. And they kept giving us lessons about, you know, sort of go with the local girls and so on. But I didn't succumb. I just, no, not tonight, no. Went out. One or two of the blokes probably did, but I didn't, no. Just a temptation because it was there, but I didn't bother.
Now, the next thing was that they moved on for some training for the invasion of Rhodes.
Oh, that.
and you signallers, they weren't using the transport, so the signallers were right up against it because they had all the gear to carry.
Well, you got to carry a pack on your back, yeah.
Do you remember how they organised it all and what sort of special training you were doing?
Well, we used to have to. They were called a number one radio set. That was the early radio set. It was called a number one. That was the one where we had those sixpennies to tighten the old nuts up, yeah. And they used to make slings and sling them on your back, and you used to have to say go 100 yards, and then the next day you go 150 yards, and sort of in jerks. And they said, well, you'd be pleased to know that they expect 80% casualties. So, I mean, that was a thing for a start. That put the wind up everybody. And a bloke called Sergeant Brown on the gunners, he was supposed to be in charge of a battery. And they were sort of mountain battery guns, and you just have to. One section carried the peas, and the other section carried the wheels, and the other carried the ammunition. And they were sweating cobs. I mean, it's not over in Egypt. But with us, we did a sort of, same to say, 50 yards, 150 yards, and just really carry, we've got to carry the batteries, we've got to carry the
It says wires. In the book that you used a stretcher thing for carrying the wireless sets and batteries. Is that how you remember it, or were you using these packs?
No, I think mainly we were sort of strapped on the back, you know, sort of. You know, like a haversack. I mean, with the army haversack, I mean, you got those kind of things. But, I mean, they weren't terribly heavy, these number one sets. You know, probably like that, you know, so. See them on your back. And I think ammunition blokes would have stretcher bearers to carry the, you know, the ammunition, but we didn't. Not Sims anyway.
And anything else? Did you actually do any training in, you know, for a landing, or did you not get?
Being a youngster, I mean, we're in Lazarus, I mean, a lot of Boy Scouts. And we got on one boat. My pal in Yala White, I mean, he was a sailor, so he knew what I was talking about. And he's got a photograph of one of them boats. LTBs and LTSs. Well, you take, I think, about 22 men and one vehicle. And you sort of strung around the old vehicle. And the old driver, the old pilot, he'd take you out and he'd take you so far in the canal, and then he'd say, right, we're coming back in into land. And when we came into land, we'd say, get closer in, we'll get bloody wet. They said, I can't, he said, this is an invasion. He said, you might be in 9 foot of water. He said, you've got to be prepared for it. So we kept saying, bring us in a bit more, come on. So, you know this idea of this shelf? We used to find that shelf first, bring it into there, and when we came aboard, off, you know, ashore, we were only paddling up to there.
Just above your ankles.
And one of the sort majors said, that's no bloody good. He said, you want to get out? He said, don't forget, you've got to invade your road. He said, you'll see a lot of water over there. He said, take him out again, go. I'll show you how it's done. And he did. He disappeared. He didn't find that shelf. I don't want to remember. He's dead. He's dead now. Hardy, sergeant major Hardy.
Jim Hardy.
Jim Hardy. Yeah, he was. He's our sergeant major. He was a bloke who disappeared. And funny thing, he got a tin hat on at the time because he was supposed to be a real McCoy, and his tin hat sort of started to float on the water and then disappeared. And he was down below. He'd gone. And we all said like that sergeant major. You know, when they pulled him out. That was that.
What did you think of Jim Hardy?
He was good. He was all right. Good bloke. Bit of a Bible puncher, but
religious, you mean?
Yeah. Mm. Whenever he went into action, he had a book similar to that, a bit smaller, for writing stuff on, you know, for praise and on the front, he used to have a quotation of the Bible. I always remember it because in this world you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. And that was on every book he had, whether it was an old one or a new one. And I always remember that quotation. And it was as good as gold. You know. And what do you call him? He was always shutting his backside, you know. And people used to take the bicket, you know. Hey, there's Jim, you've got. Yeah.
So one of them said they called him Nat Scratchers.
That's it, yeah. He was scratching his arse. So. And he didn't know he was doing it, you see. It sort of, I suppose, over the years, it became automatic. He'd stand there in front of him and sort of, you know.
And Nelly, some of them called him Nelly, I think.
Well, they call him Nelly because, I mean, anybody that's a bit sort of that way inclined, I mean, they are Nellies, you know.
What do you mean that way inclined? Sorry.
Yes. I don't know. You say. I wouldn't say he was a homosexual, but he was a bit like an old woman sort of thing, you know. That's why they call him Nelly. Nelly's an old fashioned name for. An old girl, like, you know, and he was like an old woman, so.
Because he wasn't very old, was he?
No,
he was only about 24 when he died. Anything else?
He got a shell all to himself. He did. Went through the side of the tank and straight through him, armour piercing.
What about anything else about the training for Rhodes? Anything else you remember?
That was about it. We used to dodge a lot of training. We did.
How would you do that?
You find yourself some other job, you know.